Welcome to Flat Chat with me, Stuart Codling, and joining me here in the biblically not quite flooded offices of the Motorsport Network is the editor of F1 Racing, Ben Anderson.
Hello, Codders.
And down the line from, where are you, Mark? It's Mark Gallagher.
I'm in Oxfordshire, Silicon Valley of Formula One.
Now, we can see some marvellous pictures on the wall behind you. Can you identify them for us?
So that one is Fangio winning the Po Grand Prix in 1949 in his Maserati 4CLT.
Oh, fabulous.
Very nice.
Which I sat in Goodwood at the Revival a couple of weekends ago. Not that actual car, but its sister car. Pretty amazing piece of technology. And that one is the other thing that interests me. So that's a plane, a World War II plane, which a well-known Formula One photographer and journalist called Jeff Hutchinson actually discovered and rebuilt and flew again, restored back to its former glory. So, yeah, his twin passions, aviation and car racing.
Was Jeff Hutchinson the guy who went off to become a helicopter pilot or something post F1? He pretty well could fly.
He could pretty well fly anything, Jeff, as far as I can understand it. And he was very much at the forefront of media coverage of Formula One through the 70s and 80s and 90s. When I started working in Formula One, Jeff was, you know, right there, center stage, one of the better known journalists. And then he just often disappeared. He decided not to age disgracefully in Formula One, go do something else which involved flying planes.
I don't think anyone else in the Formula One photographic fraternity is quite so multi-talented these days. I mean, I know a couple of them do adult photography in there as a sideline, but let's
adult photography.
Shall we leave that to the imagination?
Yeah, let's leave that to the imagination.
Do you ever get offered a lift in his helicopter?
Did I? No, I never flew with Jeff. And yeah, plenty of helicopters and private jets along the way, but I'm afraid not with Jeff, no.
I've never been in a private jet. It's not one that I'd add to my citation.
I have. I've been in Jonathan Palmer's private jet and his helicopter.
Did you check to make sure it didn't have anything written underneath by a vandal?
As far as I could tell, he dropped me off at Lingfield Racecourse.
Speaking of, it's
very nice to get dropped off in a private jet. My recollection of that period of my career was that it was like time travel, because you could get everywhere so quickly.
Yeah,
it was nuts. I have a distinct recollection of us finishing the Grand Prix at the Nürburgring at, you know, after like an hour and 40 minutes, it was like 20 to 4. And I was sitting in my living room in Oxford at 5:30. You know, my wife was saying, "Why are you here?"
What, generally or just specifically at that moment?
I think that was probably quite a general comment at the time, actually. But why are you here? You're supposed to be at the Grand Prix. Yeah, it's just bizarre.
I was at a race in Austria at the, what used to be the A1 ring, when I got my private travel from the Palmers, and I made it back home before my commercial flight that was originally booked was due to take off from Vienna. It was incredible.
Oh, that's a nice feeling.
Yeah,
it's
really nice. Yeah.
Did Mrs. Anderson pose a similarly existential question to you when you walked through the door and she put down her Jean-Paul Sartre book and said, "Why are you here?"
Fortunately, she wasn't there.
On the subject of being dropped off, hopefully subscribers will now have this latest issue of F1 Racing arriving on their doorsteps, literally in their hands. We have just taken delivery of the new issue of F1 Racing, which will be on the newsstands tomorrow. And on the front is a rather marvellous image of Max Verstappen taken at the Belgian Grand Prix. You arrived, Ben, with the photographer in tow, him looking a little bit sweaty and hassled, having lugged his gear up the stairs. Now, this month in F1 Racing, we look at the rise of artificial intelligence in Formula One. We speak to Alex Albon and Daniel Kvyat. And the long interview is with Alfa Romeo's Frédéric Vasseur. And you won't actually believe which driver he names as someone pivotal to his career. Now, Ben, you are disqualified from this because you proofread this. Mark, which driver do you think Fred Vasseur would name as pivotal to his career?
Because of what you've just said in the introduction, I'm going to say Pastor Maldonado.
It's Jamie Green.
Okay, great.
Jamie Green was one of the pivotal drivers in his career because he'd his team was quite young. They'd just moved to what was the F3 Euro Series. They'd won it with Jamie Green. And it was then that he got a phone call from Martin Whitmarsh at McLaren, who were then kind of wondering what to do with Lewis Hamilton, who'd had a bit of a stinker that year in the Euro Series with Manor, and they wanted to place him with Fred's team.
One of the things which we, all of us at some point in our career, we have that moment where the network suddenly clicks into place and something maybe not that obvious then leads to a pretty interesting outcome, the phone call or the email that maybe just suddenly makes a difference. And it's interesting that Frederick can look back all those years to that as a pivotal moment.
He was very, very complimentary about Sergio Marchionne as well, said, you know, his encounter with him more recently in a team principals meeting, which set off the Alfa Romeo partnership, was also one of these turning points, as he described them. So, yeah, really interesting interview. We actually had about an hour with him, which was sort of quite unusual. He talked very chattily. He was in a part of the Alfa motorhome that I'd never been into, despite the fact that it's about 12 years old and gone through several owners. So it's one of those places where you can see out but no one can see in, which I'm sure that I'll never pick my nose in a team motorhome again. But yes, spinning on to the sort of the most pressing stuff of the issue, Max Verstappen, the exclusive interview lies within. Now, as ever with a monthly magazine, you put someone on the cover and then the weekend before it comes out, they have quite a low-profile race. But nevertheless, Max raced to a podium position in Singapore. They might have been expected to do a bit better there, but word reaches us that they had the wrong settings for the bumps on their simulator. So they arrived with basically too stiff a setup, and both drivers were having their feet bounced off the pedals, which I find extraordinary, but it doesn't detract from Max's position as kind of really the up-and-coming superstar of the age, as well as Charles Leclerc, of course.
He's emerged, hasn't he, over the past 12 months, 16 months, as probably the preeminent threat to Lewis Hamilton's status as the best driver in Formula One. And this season, I think, he's particularly been impressive up until the summer break. Certainly, he's had a couple of iffy races since then at Spa and Monza, but he's driving incredibly, and he had until his retirement at Spa an incredible run of, I think, 21 consecutive top five finishes, eclipsed only by Hamilton, whilst obviously driving a lesser package, a car that's not quite at Mercedes level, an engine that's certainly not at Mercedes level, delivering exceptional performances consistently, which is something we hadn't seen from him. We've seen the flashes previously, but now he looks like he's getting towards that title challenging level of driver, and that's what we wanted to celebrate really with this month's F1 racing, how Max, playing on the lion theme, which he also does with his own social media, unleashing the lion, he's really unleashing himself on Formula One with greater ferocity now. And if Red Bull and Honda can get their act together for next year, it could be a fascinating title battle, hopefully between him and Lewis.
Our initial idea was to have him roaring like a lion on the cover, and he told us to bog off, basically.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, I'm not into that, he said.
Him to do a 20th Century Fox lion roar on the cover. Is that pretty well the image you were
looking
for?
Yeah, not far off.
Yeah, that's what we had in mind.
I tried to help the photographer set up. I posed before Max arrived for his interview and photo shoot slot, and tried to do these aforesaid roars. And it is, I think, nearly impossible to do without looking incredibly twisted and frightening. So I don't blame him.
And those pictures probably exist somewhere, don't they? Yeah. So we can use them in your profile picture.
No, I think we need those ad techs quite urgently.
the other thing about Max is he's great for business, isn't he, in Formula 1 now? When was the last time you saw someone who was that box office dynamite?
I think probably standing on the grid at the Spanish Grand Prix one year in Barcelona and just thinking the Alonso effect was astonishing. You know, we've been coming to Barcelona for quite a long time, and then this guy arrives and it was epic. And I think, considering Germany has just dropped off the Formula One calendar next year, you know, it's not that long ago that you would turn up at Hockenheim or the Nürburgring during the Schumi era, and the Michael Schumacher effect was just extraordinary. And now we've got the Verstappen version of that. And the Dutch fans, I mean, effectively, they now have two Grand Prix because they take over Belgium. It's going to invade that part of Belgium for for the Spa weekend. Then they've got their home Grand Prix next year in Holland, and they've travelled all over the world. And it is extraordinary. And I go to Holland quite a bit on business. And what it is really interesting to see how Formula One has gone from being 5 years ago. If I asked an audience, you know, how many of you follow Formula One, you might have had a, you know, 5% might have raised their hand and said that they once went to school with Hoob Rosengatcher or something. And and now it's like everybody wants to be a Formula One fan. So you get this huge response. And they love it because they've got a winner on their hands, and they suspect that they might have their first Formula One world champion coming along. So, you know, there's a lot of things have combined with to make the Verstappen effect so profound, you know, also including the fact that we have a big sponsor in Formula One, which happens to be based in Amsterdam, which is Heineken. So you've got this kind of commercial push as well behind the sport at, in their domestic market. So it's extraordinary.
I bet ING wish they hadn't been so clobbered by the financial crisis that they could carry on sponsoring F1 as well in this day and age.
Especially with Lion.
Yeah.
See, very good point, especially with the Lion. Well, yeah, but, you know, ING, one of those sponsors that, you know, it would be lovely to hear the story from. I mean, I know some of the people who were involved in the deal when they came in with, you know, what was the Benetton-Renault team, and they... I mean, they were in and out of Formula One faster than you could say subprime mortgage. So they were, you know, it was an extraordinarily expensive sponsorship and extraordinarily short-lived, which tends to suggest it wasn't the best decision that they ever made to come in the first place, because they weren't in it for the long haul. So, yeah, I'm sure. I think there are actually a lot of Dutch companies looking at Formula One in one way or another, either in terms of hospitality or sponsorship or how can we use it, because of the Verstappen effect. So it is, this is going to seal a generation of enthusiasm within with the Dutch business and fan community.
The I suppose the only problem that he's going to create going forward, and to my mind, this is sort of quite an interesting facet of Max's career, in that his dad very much played second fiddle to Michael Schumacher at Benetton, and that kind of defined his career, didn't he? Because Jos was a great up-and-coming talent, and then placed next to Michael Schumacher looked very second-rate. And at the moment, you have whoever's sitting next to Max also looks pretty second-rate. To what extent is that team now belonging to Max, and it's pretty much a one-car team almost, or a one-and-a-half-car team?
Yeah, it's definitely shifted in that direction, really as a natural consequence of Daniel Ricciardo upping sticks and going to Renault. I think the team will readily admit, and I think Christian Horner does in the interview I did with him, that, you know, it was natural that Max would be as talented and incredible a driver as he is and was in the shadow of Daniel Ricciardo, because he was the senior partner at the team. He'd been there, he was in what, his fifth season, I think, last year, seen off Sebastian Vettel, you know, full of confidence, an older guy, big character. Big personality. It's quite hard to make yourself heard and stand out when you're up against that sort of personality. And I think Red Bull have seen a shift in Max as soon as Ricciardo has left that team, because he is by definition then the senior partner. He's the guy with more experience, and whoever comes in alongside him, if they're a young driver as Gasly and Albon are, with not anywhere near the same level of experience, the team is naturally going to gravitate towards Max, and it's all just coming together for him now, and he is building that kind of environment that Lewis has managed to do at Mercedes, that Vettel previously had done at Ferrari. Perhaps now that's shifting with the rise of Leclerc, and you can see that Max has gone up a gear in terms of his approach, in terms of his maturity, his attitude. He's much calmer in the car now than he used to be. And I think also Honda have played a big role in that, because he no longer carries the years of pent-up frustration with Renault that he had previously. Now he's working with an engine partner he believes in, and everything is moving in the right direction for him.
That's also been really fascinating this year, hasn't it? That Honda have had their problems, they've been the engine-related penalties, they've had to take a few steps back in terms of the specs, and yet Max is so much more in tune with what they want. He's been much more positive about them than he was with Renault. And he's even said that with Renault, they made promises that kind of weren't kept. I'm sounding like Alan Partridge here. I was made promises about storage which weren't kept. but the... he sort of feels that Renault didn't actually achieve a lot of the things they committed to do, whereas Honda kind of commit to do stuff and then make it happen.
Also, we should say this is still the early stages of the partnership, so they're kind of in the honeymoon period, aren't they, where they haven't quite yet worked out whether there are irreconcilable differences between each party. Also, Max is just finding his feet a bit more, isn't he? You know, he's realised, I think, the need to broaden his own horizons and realise that he's part of something much bigger than himself. And he doesn't seem to be behaving or driving like he's trying to prove himself so much now. I think with all these things happening in the background, he now feels like he's an established part of the Formula One elite. And everything we talked about in terms of the growing fan base and the Orange Army at the Grand Prix is all a part of that. He can see now that he's there to stay. He's one of the big players. He's got time on his side because, you know, he's one of the younger drivers. Yeah, exactly. You know, he can afford to be more patient than he was when he first came into Formula One, and just detuning his driving by, a few percent has brought everything back into a sphere where he can have better command of what he's doing at all moments, and the result of that is, you know, better results and far greater consistency.
Yeah. Mark, from your time at Cosworth, you must have dealt with quite a few difficult, demanding, boisterous, obstreperous drivers.
Obstreperous.
Obstreperous. I mean, actually
Partridge wouldn't have used that word.
I mean, less than Cosworth. Actually, one of the really interesting things about running the Cosworth Formula One program was how disinterested the drivers were in the engine. They just didn't really come and talk to us unless there was a particular problem. Rubens Barrichello always complained about the dip in the torque curve at 14,000 RPM, which he repeated so many times, I think everyone, including Patrick Head, got really bored with it. So it was, apart from that, no one talked to me about it. I think more interesting for me was, founding Status Grand Prix and doing the A1 GP Championship and then GP3 and GP2, meeting young drivers on the way up and finding, you know, just all of humanity sitting across the desk from you at some point in time when you're talking to young drivers about their future careers and realizing the extent to which what's going on inside the head is 100% of the battle. And something I was talking to Martin Brundle about at the weekend in Singapore was the sort of mental happiness that you have and the mental focus that you have and how the engineering of that is just as important as the engineering of the car. So I think with Max, everything Ben has just said is absolutely spot on. He's come into his own this year, partly because he's finally the number one driver. There's no doubt about that. Daniel decided to leave the team. And weirdly enough, in Daniel making that decision, it helped Max enormously because Max is no longer looking over his shoulder at his teammate with any sense of concern. So it's his team. And he has settled down. I think I remember we talked about in a previous podcast about the unhappy beginning to the 2018 season that he had and the mistake. Everyone remembers the shunt in Monaco, for example, and how unsettled he was. And of course, he was protesting at the time that he wasn't doing anything wrong and he wasn't going to examine how his driving style had deteriorated or whether he was pushing too hard. And of course, now he admits to all of those things. He admits that he was trying too hard. He was overdriving the car. And he actually calmed down, and the last, you know, season and a bit have been exemplary. So he's really come into his own. Extraordinary to think that at the age of 21, he will take part in his 100th Grand Prix in Austin, Texas. Here's a guy who really has had the perfect young apprenticeship in Formula One, and he's coming into his own with, my goodness, you know, he's got 15 years ahead of him if he wants to.
It's amazing how young they are these days, isn't it, when they're kind of getting towards the point of being able to graduate to Formula One. And there's such a broad spread of drivers because you have the 21-year-olds, you have people coming in at 18 or 19, and then you have people extending their careers. You've got, you know, Kimi Raikkonen, who's knocking on 40 and still, you know, he's not quite the Kimi he was sort of 15 years ago, but you know, he's still pretty handy and he's a driver you would hire to do a job.
Yeah, and he's doing a fantastic job at Alpha, isn't he? He's been perfect for that team. But then Kimi's one of those, I guess, almost unique personalities where he almost doesn't have an ego And he's a guy who's won the World Championship and several Grand Prix, been at the forefront of Formula One, and he's happy to toil around in the midfield just because he loves being in Formula One and he loves driving. And I don't think there are many world champions who would be able to stomach that drop down the grid from a top team and a top seat.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point about Kimi. He's got that utter couldn't care less attitude in so many ways, and yet he clearly loves driving Formula One cars. So he doesn't worry about the critics. He just goes and does his own thing. And as you say, Ben, since he was bounced out of Ferrari and joined Alfa Romeo, he's almost been like a new man. You know, he's actually enjoying driving in a midfield team. There's no pressure or expectation on him to win races, so he's just out there collecting as many points as he possibly can, apart from his, you know, couple of recent mistakes, including Singapore.
He's also a little bit more talkative in his press conferences, and I say that advisedly, a little bit more talkative. He's relaxed just a tiny little bit, but he's...
Now, Kimi's a great talker, though. If you get him in the right circumstances and away from the glare of cameras, he can talk for hours. He can be hard to shut up.
Yeah,
does that involve copious amounts of ice cream or vodka?
Probably.
I'm sure he's very talkative and on the social occasions, but not exclusively. I remember doing an interview with him for Autosport a few years ago, and Ferrari. So at the time, he was at Ferrari, and you know, maximum pressure in terms of his working environment. And I was allocated 10 minutes, I think, to speak to him for this cover feature we're doing about his career and, you know, his life and times in Formula One. And we talked for over an hour. He just kept going. Fortunately, the Ferrari PR team let the thing take its course and didn't try to intervene. Yeah, I think we ended up doing 65 or 70 minutes. Completely different kind of Kimi that you tend to see in front of the cameras or in the press conferences, where, you know, he's not interested in talking to the world and answering stupid questions. He picks and chooses his battles.
Yeah, an extraordinary performance by the no doubt then Ferrari PR team as well, because they were very much known for saying no. I don't know why I did a French impression.
In French?
Yeah, no. he's not happening.
No, they were very accommodating. And it was good. I felt very proud to have such a long interview with Kimi Räikkönen, especially as my desk at the time had been, you know, joking with me about, will you even be able to fill the 10 minutes?
It does happen. You know, sometimes you do get people like him who are not feeling talkative. At other times, you know, like you say, they're unparalleled in their loquacity, and you can barely shut them up and keep them on subject, which is quite bizarre. I suppose we should probably grasp the nettle of Robert Kubica, given that we've interviewed him in this issue, and he's also someone who used to be...
Was he in loquacious form?
He was in loquacious form, and it's kind of been interesting because, you know, I interviewed him years ago when he was at BMW for a cover feature in F1 Racing, and then, you know, he went off the scene in an enforced way for a few years, then interviewed him again at the beginning of this year when he came back with Williams, and he was really, really cagey at that time, and he was back to the sort of the I don't really like doing interviews Robert that he used to be. But then this interview we did, which was in Spa, so unfortunately it was before he'd taken the decision, or before he'd announced the decision that he wasn't going to be driving with Williams again next year, he just seemed a lot more relaxed and very much talking off the cuff, and it was a very honest interview, which I found quite revealing, and I think I got the impression that he wouldn't actually admit it, but he said at the beginning of the year he'd just seemed a little bit cautious, or if not nervous, certainly a little bit cagey about whether he would actually properly be able to race a Formula One car again, and then he'd actually almost surprised himself by the fact that he'd done it. And he said, you know, I've proved that my limitation isn't a limitation, because he talks about his injured arm as a limitation, because he drives 70% left-handed by his own admission. But he said once he'd actually got driving the car again, he realised that actually his goal had been to come back to Formula One, But now, actually, the real hard work has started because he's got to justify his position. I think that's what he's been fighting to do all year. So, kind of, I suppose the question is, what next for Robert Kubica? Is it that he just doesn't enjoy racing at the back? I get the impression he feels he needs to enjoy what he's doing. So he wants to be in Formula One, but he also wants to enjoy being in Formula One. And that must be very difficult when you're in the worst car on the grid.
Yeah, I think it's just really a step too far probably for Robert, because he's always going to be judged in the minds of fans and people who remember his first career, if you like, in Formula One as, you know, one of the elite. You know, he was a driver that the likes of Alonso and Hamilton talked of as their, you know, their biggest threat, the guy they most watched coming through. I think Lewis said, you know, in karting, Kubica was the guy that he was most worried about. So when you have reached that standard in the minds of your peers and proved it on the track by winning a race, you know, in lesser machinery, you are always going to be held to that standard. And Robert's been out of Formula One for so long, plus having this limitation with his injury, which does affect how he performs, even if he claims that it doesn't. He does not claim that it doesn't, but even if he says that it doesn't stop him from driving, which is true. And then you throw in the fact that he's in the worst car on the grid in a team that's got problems behind the scenes and is trying to sort all of that out. You can't expect Robert Kubica to perform as the Robert Kubica of old performed. But in Formula One, you have to perform at the highest level. There is no hiding place. And he's just, unfortunately, I think, as he is now, been slightly found out at that level. I think all those things that he's missed from being out for so long. Now, he mentioned, I think, in your feature, Codders, that he hadn't driven a Formula One car in the wet for 9 years until the German Grand Prix. 9 years of experience you've missed out on compared to your rivals. Okay, not all of them have been in Formula One for all of that time, but even, you know, the guys who've stepped up from F2 who've all been outstanding, by the way, as well, in their rookie seasons, you know, they've had constant racing experience progressing through the categories, getting in cars that are closer and closer in spec to Formula One as they go. They're just so plugged into the minute details that make all the difference in terms of how the tyres are, in terms of prevailing thoughts, in terms of setups and how you work the cars for different tracks. Robert hasn't had that, and he's had to try and relearn all of that stuff in an impossibly short time frame while in an environment that just isn't suitable for a guy who's got so much to take care of on his own. You know, he needed to be in a car that was well sorted, in a team that had everything, you know, clicking and running smoothly to have even half a chance of being decent this year. And ultimately, you know, we call the feature Kubica's mountain climb, and it's a climb I just don't think he's going to be able to complete.
I never understood the big drive to get him back into a Formula One cockpit, other than his own personal ambition to show to himself and maybe to show to the world that he could still do it. But
I mean, that's how it started, isn't it, Mark? You know, Renault did it really as an emotional gesture, if you like, to a driver that they treasured, and it grew a life of its own from that. Really, that's probably where it should have stopped.
But there were some. You know, very authoritative media really, really campaigning, really supporting, you know, like, got to get, you know, it's great to have Kubica back in Formula One. He's such a giant talent. The guy had a life-changing injury. And, I mean, I think that when you look at it dispassionately and you say, actually, what on earth was he thinking that he would be able to come back into Formula One and compete at the very pinnacle, truly competitively? Forget whether Williams produced a competitive car or not. If the Williams had produced a Mercedes beating car this year, I think it would have looked even worse for Robert Kubica, because he would have at the very pinnacle of the sport been shown up even further. And had he had, for example, a sort of Hamilton, Leclerc, Verstappen level of teammate in a truly competitive car, I think it would have been really an extremely painful experience. And I say this knowing full well that he has literally a whole country behind him. We were talking about the Verstappen effect in Holland. I mean, the Kubica effect in Poland has to be seen to be believed. Polish fans are extraordinary. They love Robert, what he stands for. They actually love the fact that, you know, he's battled back to get into Formula One, and they are gutted to see the way this year has panned out, and I completely understand that. But this is the pinnacle of global motorsport, and to compete at this level, everything has to be perfect. How often do we talk about all those marginal gains, all those incremental improvements that have to be made to get to the point where you get into a truly competitive winning position? And ultimately, the human tragedy of what happened to Robert was always going to be burdening that return down, allied to the fact that it's 8 years or whatever since he'd been in Formula One. So it was unlikely that it was ever going to end happily. And in some ways, the surprise is it's taken this long through the year before the decision has been made that he's not going to continue with Williams. I thought before the summertime, how much does this guy really want to keep on going with this? And, you know, if he continues in Formula One as a test driver or a simulator driver or something, I suspect that one of the principal driving forces behind that will be whether he can bring his major sponsor, Orlen, the Polish energy company, with him as a sponsor to another team, because that will actually is more likely to guarantee his continued involvement in a team in some capacity than anything else.
Yeah, it's a really good point, because that has been key to his having the Williams race seat in the first place, isn't it? Yeah. Again, this is not Kubica being in the car purely because he's a Robert Kubica one-time Grand Prix winner. It's because he can bring Polish sponsorship money, and even that is a mark of how, again, speaking dispassionately, how far his stock has fallen, if you like, in the time that, you know, through no fault of his own, he's been out of the seat.
There's been a lot of frustration, certainly from the Polish fan side, about the way things have panned out, haven't they? There's been a lot of criticism on social media and thereabouts, the various corners of the internet, people saying that he hasn't been given equal equipment. They say the team's been favouring his British teammate. There's been varying degrees of tinfoil hattery, and I did ask him about that with the specific intention of kind of hoping he'd shoot it down. He didn't quite 100% shoot it down. He did say the cars were different at the beginning of the year and that he was feeling different things from George Russell, but that now, obviously speaking a month or so ago, things have changed and their feedback was broadly similar. And when he said that, I kind of thought, and it made me quite glad that when we'd first applied to Williams, or we'd made the request to interview Robert, we'd sort of had it in mind to do it in Hungary, and they'd said, oh, sorry, he's too busy, we're kind of fully booked then. And then, of course, the Hungarian Grand Prix weekend went on, and he had a bit of a stinker. I think that was his worst weekend of the year in terms of his relative performance to Russell, and it looked like Russell had found something in the way they worked the tyres that Robert just couldn't do. And to me, that had felt like almost kind of the breakthrough moment where, even after the race, Robert was so disheartened and people were asking him about the tyres, and he was quite unusually snappy and grumpy. And I kind of thought, well, it's all over. Are we actually going to be able to speak to him in Spa? And then he was sort of all sweetness and light. So it left me a little bit confused as to where his mind was. But certainly he doesn't feel that he's been stitched up at all.
He probably had the summer to think on, didn't he? Yeah. And process everything that had happened in the first half of the year and come to terms with the fact that ultimately he just isn't at the level required. Yeah. You know, if you analyse for F1 teammates' pure pace performance relative to each other so far this year, I think he's second worst. I think he's only behind Gasly relative to Verstappen, and only I think Stroll and Perez are slightly ahead. So that's the bracket he's in terms of relative performance. That's not going to be good enough for a guy who's been so successful in the past and obviously has a, you know, champion's mentality. And Hungary would have been the point at which the penny dropped, I guess, because he could no longer even partially hide behind, you know, possible differences in spec or, you know, the team being behind in terms of its production schedules. At Williams, okay, they're far off the pace, but in terms of their operations, they were much more at a normal level by Hungary. And we saw George Russell, you know, nearly make Q2. Robert was nowhere near that level in cars that, you know, as he admits in your interview, you know, they're handling the same or they're feeling the same thing. So he has nowhere to hide then. I'm sure he's going to be grumpy because, you know, he has to then look in the mirror and say, oh, it's me. I'm the one who's not doing the right things. And it's quite similar in what we were talking about earlier with Max Verstappen. You know, Mark, you mentioned Monaco 2018, that was the key moment for Max, because up until that point, every one of his kind of major incidents or, you know, errors, you could make a case that someone else was to blame or at least had some involvement in what went wrong. But Monaco, he crashed in FP3 on his own, needlessly. There is no one else he could blame for that. So eventually, even if he wanted to protest at the time, he had to come to terms with the fact that he was to blame for throwing away a victory and that he needed to change something to make sure that didn't happen again. And Roberts found himself in that position up against George Russell at Williams.
They're both sides, if we can even call them sides, have been very dignified about this, haven't they? Robert has steered away from criticising the team, and the team have been very, very protective of him. Like we saw in Hungary, Claire Williams saying, I'm never going to say to Robert, you need to do better. And that was very, it struck me as being very impressive. But I don't know, Mark, do you think there's more to that they're kind of hoping to retain Robert and his lucrative sponsorship to the end of the year? Or is that a genuine Claire Williams thing? She thinks she's going to get more out of a driver by being protective.
Claire's default is always to protect her team, and the drivers are part of the team. And that's just her natural instinct. I think it is the right way. It is the right way to be. I think Claire naturally would have been protective of him, and I'm sure will be very disappointed that this deal and this relationship has turned out to be so short-lived, really.
Indeed. And on the subject of dirty laundry, your column this month, and I'm mindful of the fact, mentioning dirty laundry, that my boxer shorts are currently drying out on the armrest of our managing editor's chair after today's biblical downpour.
We should also point out that Stuart is sitting dressed in replacement
clothing.
He hasn't cast his only underpants to the armchair of the production editor.
Okay, that's good to know.
It's highly fortunate. Well, excuse me, I brought my running kit in yesterday, hoping to go for a run, and then sort of developed this sore throat that felt like I'd swallowed a loofah. So I ended up not actually doing the run, but had a spare set of togs with which to change into. One of the big stories this year has been Daniel Ricciardo going to court with Glenn Beavis, his former sort of advisor, manager, whatever. You tackle that in your column this month. I wanted to headline it, Ricciardo and Beavis butt heads, but was overruled. And
I'm very disappointed that was overruled. It wasn't by you, Ben. No.
Maybe it was our currently absent managing editor who said, you can't call it that.
Yeah, nipped in the bud before it made it to me.
I thought that when I heard about the court case, which has been initiated by Glenn Beavis, and those listeners who perhaps have watched the Netflix series Drive to Survive on Formula One, which has had a lot of comment about it, will remember there are a couple of episodes in which Glenn Beavis appears as Daniel's advisor, talking about the fact that they have a range of options as to who to drive for this year. He could stay at Red Bull, could go to Renault, and talking about the wisdom of going to Renault. And I remember watching that and thinking, what a weird conversation. Why would you want to go to Renault? And then obviously realizing it had to do with money. And then sure enough, the deal has happened. And then Daniel has changed management. And Glenn Beavis has gone after him for what he believes are monies owed on commissions on the main deal. And therein lies the tussle that's going to take place, hopefully, and be sorted out privately between them, but might end up going to court. And it's just yet another disruption to the career of Daniel Ricciardo, and not what he needed at all, because these things take up an inordinate amount of time. If when you're not driving the race car, you're having to wade through statements and talk to lawyers and have conference calls and maybe even, go to some lawyer's office a couple of times a month to talk about the latest developments in the case. It's just all distracting. And the one thing we know about top performing sports people is the more distractions you have in your head, the less you're focusing on the task in hand. So it all seems very unfortunate and another example of the naivety, I think, of people within the sport when things are not documented and contracted in a crystal clear way, and where drivers and managers don't have a relationship that is crystal clear, and because where you leave uncertainty, where friendships blur relationships at the top level of this sport, there's almost an inevitability that it's going to get messy. And I've seen it many times before, and it's just a shame to see it happen to Daniel Ricciardo and Glenn Beavis. And I you know, don't know who's right or who's wrong on either side as to what occurred, but it's again another sort of lesson as to why drivers' careers need to be managed in the right way, because the wrong way gets very messy very quickly.
Very detailed, isn't it? And it's all in the details, like whether when you give someone a watch, it's actually a gift or in lieu of commission. It's almost a shame, especially if someone is more of a friend or confidant than actual official contracted manager, that you have to sort of lay out very clearly what such things are.
Yes, like Mark says, it's sort of about having things written down, isn't it? You know, keep it clear, and then you don't run into trouble, because this is quite a messy situation. You know, if it goes to court, and you know, when we did the original reporting of this story, I contacted Daniel and got the only statement really he's given publicly on this, which is that he's determined to fight it, and you know, he said it's a baseless claim. So that's quite a strong position to take. But to do that, if it goes all the way, he's going to have to confront some quite sensitive details regarding his contracts with Renault that Renault surely are not going to be very happy to have to deal with in a public forum. And certainly, you know, if the likes of Cyril Abitbol et al. Are going to have to be called to a witness stand to talk about exactly what went on behind the scenes and who said what during negotiations, that's a whole hornet's nest you really don't want to disturb, I don't think, from Daniel Ricciardo's
point of view. I pity the stenographer when Cyril takes the stand.
Yeah, it could be quite verbose. So it's the kind of thing really that, you know, as Mark was alluding to, Daniel really needs to draw a line under as quickly as possible, I think, and move on from. And, you know, if that costs him a few quid to make it go away, then probably so be it. You take it on the chin and say, right, from now on, we make sure we draw our lines very clearly in the sand before we get into bed with anybody.
Yeah. Mark, if you were Daniel's current manager stroke legal eagle, would you be saying to him, tell you what, mate, it's better to actually settle this out of court than go to court and have basically all your financial dealings aired in a public forum where basically the contents of your bank account are going to be writ large for the media to feast on?
If I were in that position, I would be basing all of my advice based on the facts and the truth of what occurred. And if the facts and the truth are that there was a kind of at least a moral obligation to look after Glenn Beavis in some way, then even if it, not everything was documented, then I think, yes, perhaps a settlement might be required just to make the problem go away and get rid of this time-consuming and expensive case. If, however, as a driver manager, you feel that the driver is being fleeced by, you know, a disgruntled former manager, and I'm not saying that, you know, he's being fleeced by Glenn, I'm just saying that if you believe that the case is without foundation, you should fight it, because ultimately you will win it, and ultimately if you win it and costs are awarded against the other side, then the other side's going to be in a real spot of bother. So it all comes down to what the real truth of the matter is, and only really Daniel and Glenn will know the answer to that. They will have spent many hours together. You know, Netflix were invited in to record what was supposed to be a kind of fly on the wall discussion between them about this year. I'm sure they had lots of very serious conversations and spent a lot of time together, and you know, they'll know whether undertakings were made about the future. So that it all comes down to the truth. And if you know, at a time when fake news and fake truths seem to abound around the world, the reality is, when it comes to legal matters, there is going to be a very clear view as to what the likely outcome is, and they should then follow that path. And by the way, Daniel Ricciardo's management now is Creative Artists CAA, who represent such people as Nico Rosberg, and in fact they work with Formula One, and I believe that they did, I don't know if they still do, but I believe they actually represented Red Bull Racing, oddly enough, as a team in sponsorship, and then they have similar contracted out to a company in Sydney in Australia called Aspire Talent Group to represent Daniel's interests at home in Australia. So he's now got heavyweight people behind him and managing him and looking to help the rest of his professional career. And these people will have huge amounts of expertise in relation to be able to advise him on this case. So I think, he will be in the right hands, and I'm sure the right decisions will be made based on what the facts and the truth of this situation really is.
Yeah, I reckon going into court with them lot is a little bit like walking onto a rugby pitch with the All Blacks in front of you about to do the haka.
Yeah, and I tell you, one of the things which is so interesting in when you worked in Formula One, and if you do end up in court, I've been called as an expert witness on three occasions to fairly heavy high court cases involving Formula One entities suing each other and whatever. And it's a hugely uncomfortable experience for absolutely everyone. And I mean, even as an expert witness, you're being challenged on everything that you say. And I remember spending 5 hours in the dock one day being challenged about driver contracts and test driver contracts and mileages that they should be allowed and how much was paid and how much does it cost to drive a lap in a Formula One car so that a sponsorship can be, fully evaluated. And I mean, it stressed the limits of my, expertise. It really did. It was a fascinating experience, but I was only a witness. If you are one party or the other, everything is on the line, and it's hugely expensive. It's not for the faint-hearted, and litigation, I think, should only ever be undertaken in the most extreme of circumstances.
Yeah, I think any listeners wanting to get a perspective on how nasty it can get probably don't have to look too far around the internet to see proceedings in the Ferrari and McLaren battle in 2007. Nigel Tozzi, Ferrari's QC, made absolute mincemeat of Paddy Lowe in the dock, and it made for very difficult reading. If we direct our podcast towards the off-ramp and the gilded final page of the issue, which is my column, which this month we talk about the subject of new teams, and it came as a bit of a surprise to me, although maybe it shouldn't be, that certainly came as a bit of a surprise to Ross Brawn. There's been a number of approaches to Formula One about possible new entries. Ross Brawn's take seems to be that they're welcome so long as they're not crap. I'm paraphrasing. That's probably our take on it as well, if we're going to do a hot take. The question is, does Formula One actually need more teams? And if so, who would they be anyway?
I mean, the surprising thing is that anyone is surprised that there are people who want to do Formula One. There are always people who want to do Formula One. There is always a little queue. Sometimes it gets a little bit longer, but there's always a queue of people who would love to come and do this sport. And I recently was at a meeting where some of the names were mentioned, and they're all familiar names. They're people who've been involved in the sport before. They're people who, for one reason or another, have found themselves exiting Formula One, and they want to come back to it because they've got the bug. So you've got, former team principals, you've got former team investors, former team bosses, all, interested, can I create a new entity in Formula One? Is Liberty desperate to have an 11th or a 12th team? And could I possibly be the team to get that? And to the point that Ross Brawn has made, of course, there's people out there who want to do it. There are even people out there who want to do it who have got perhaps the management skill set to run a Formula One team. But that doesn't mean anything. Have you got the money to do it? The money is the key thing. If there's no money, or there's not enough money, and what do we mean by enough money? We mean enough money to absolutely guarantee a year or two of preparation. So that's a year or two where you don't do any racing, you don't have any sponsorship coming in, you've just got to fund the development of everything. In my view, it's kind of 2 years. And then you also need to be able to guarantee probably the first 3 years of operation, because if you're coming into Formula One looking for Liberty to give you a big handout, it isn't going to happen. The 10 existing teams are not going to be very happy at someone turning up tomorrow morning, cap in hand, looking for $40 or $50 million contribution every year from Liberty. It's not going to take place. You've got to have 5 years of financial wherewithal to do Formula One, and that to me sounds like about $300 to $400 million of available resource over that period of time. And there are not many people who can put their hand on that kind of money.
There are.
Definitely not me.
There's the odd eccentric millionaire around, but I'm not sure whether they're going to chuck that sort of money into a project.
But this is exactly, sorry to interrupt, but this is exactly the problem. There actually are millionaires around. Millionaires don't cut it. There are tens of thousands of millionaires. You need to be a multi-billionaire to even consider doing Formula One. And most multi-billionaires have made their money because they're very good and astute business people. And when they look at Formula One, we're running a team, unless you're in the top half of the grid, running a team is actually a financial liability. Why would you come and do it? Gene Haas has done it, and he's doing it because he's evolved a very different business model, a very low headcount in terms of staff and buying a lot of intellectual property from Ferrari. But as we have talked about in previous podcasts, the decision to accept the sponsorship from Rich Energy, I think sort of was indicative of the fact that even billionaire Gene Haas and his team are looking for any available sponsorship now to come in and support them, because the day will come when Gene or his accountant will wake up and decide this is not for us any further. And that's just the reality of the expense of competing in Formula One.
And that's a team that's been having success, you know, for a new team. What Haas has done on the track has been incredible, but in a very particular set of circumstances and according to a very particular business model, as Mark mentioned. You know, if you're going to set up a conventional constructor, say the rules for 2021 go the way that, you know, Williams and McLaren hope, which is that, you know, some of this technical partnership stuff is reined in and actually you have to do more of your own heavy lifting, that's going to require way more capital investment, even around the budget cap. You know, these new teams coming in always is expected when a budget cap is being talked about, and in this case is going to likely be in the rules, because it gives people a fixed target, but it's still so much more than that that's required. And I remember talking to Trevor Carlin, who, you know, has run a very, very successful junior single-seater operation, much like Fred Vasseur did before he came into Formula 1 with Renault and then Alpha, when new teams were last being talked about coming into Formula 1, and saying, you know, why is this not something that comes on to your radar? And he always says, well, not only do I have to find ridiculous amounts of money just to start the team up, it's all the money that you're behind the other teams in terms of year on year on year investment and infrastructure and understanding, you know, IP, wind tunnels, everything. You can't catch that up in one big spend or a few years. You know, you're always starting the race with one arm tied behind your back, never mind all the other difficulties you have. So it's a massive non-starter for most people who are properly engaged in motor racing anyway. And when you consider that Formula One is struggling to attract new manufacturers, people don't want to deal with the engine formula. Now that's a big no-no straight away, isn't it? Because you can't as even a very serious, credible racing operation do a nice tie-up with a manufacturer that would like to come in and doesn't fancy doing it with the existing teams. It's just not on the table. So you've got to fund everything privately, and that is so difficult to do. There are not businesses waiting around hoping that someone snaps them up for sponsorship. You know, it's a hard world out there, harder probably than ever. And you can see actually the structure of existing teams is moving more in the direction of one billionaire oligarchic, if you like, owner, because they are the only people now, as Mark mentioned, with the money to do Formula One.
And Trevor should know, because he, if memory serves, way back in the dim and distant, he turned up as, was it sporting director of Midland when Alex Schneider bought it and there was the Colin Collis thing?
It was a pity in a way that Trevor had such a short-lived and I think, frankly, not particularly productive experience in Formula One, because he's a super talented guy. And, you know, Trevor's team, as Ben well knows, is one of those junior teams which, if the world was a different place, could make a transition to Formula One. And certainly from a racing team perspective and from a racing management perspective, Trevor has what it takes. I think for me, the really intriguing point when we talk about new teams coming in and new money coming into Formula One, if I was an investor, I don't know that I would create a new team. when actually there are opportunities with existing teams, or there may be opportunities that you could create with existing teams. So if you look at a team like Williams, we've talked about a number of times this year, the disappointing season they're having. You know, if you had access to a big chunk of investment for Formula One, you know, that might make a very sensible approach. So rather than starting from scratch, actually doing what the shareholders of Sauber did, which was to take an existing team that was going through a difficult patch, put some really good money in, put some good management in to support the existing leadership there. And then, I mean, in 2 years, that team has been completely and utterly transformed from what it was. So there's an opportunity to do that with Williams, perhaps, and you know, I don't know if Claire and the family and the other shareholders are open to that, but if you had a big chunk of money, the opportunity to go to Williams and say, can I contribute to getting you back to where you deserve to be as an organization? I'd like to be part of that journey. Because of the Formula One team business and because of the Williams Advanced Engineering business, you have got a really quite impressive opportunity to develop something really meaty with an existing operation rather than starting from scratch with all of the difficulties that Trevor Carling pointed out when you talked to him, Ben.
I guess it'll depend on how this new partnership with Rocket works out and how much money there is there to, you know, expand the partnership, because Williams have been experimenting with this approach for a while, haven't they? You know, they did a tie with SMP, that didn't work out. They did a very intricate deal with the Strolls, you know, that fell by the wayside. So it's a very difficult match to make, isn't it? You have to find the right investor with the right attitude and one that fits with what the team wants to do, because a team like Williams has a very long established way of going racing, a firm culture that they are determined to hold on to. They're not so malleable as some other organisations have been in the past in terms of fighting for survival in Formula One. So, you know, even if there are investors around with the sort of cash needed to do Formula One just waiting to bite someone's arm off, it's not that easy to then go to an existing team and just pump that money in, because you're going to want to do things a certain way and you have to hope that that way fits with the team that you're trying to invest in.
Jonathan Kendrick's quite an interesting character, because he
featured in this issue.
Featured in this issue, indeed. And it's good that you mentioned Rocket, because he's very different from some of their previous investors, particularly Lawrence Stroll, in that he wants to keep a low profile. He just wants his brands to benefit from the marketing buzz, but he doesn't want to be centre stage. And the first thing he said to me when we sat down was, "Well, I don't know what you want to talk to me for."
That's what you want to hear, isn't it?
Well, you know, once he'd got going, he was thoroughly loquacious, but and has a very interesting life story. But he doesn't want to be the story. He just wants to support a team that was very important to him personally where at the beginning of his career, but also that his businesses benefit from it. And no one gets involved in Formula One, ultimately, unless they're spending other people's money. If you're running a business, you only want to get involved in Formula One to advance that business, unless something's very, very wrong with your outlook. Now, we've seen people come and go, and yet not go. For instance, Rich Energy, their Twitter account, still tweeting on about Formula One as if they're still part of it. So it's a bizarre universe, and like you say, Mark, some people just can't seem to
can't let it go.
Yeah, they can't stay away for long. On that note, it is time for us to go our separate ways. Mark, you need to turn your hands to the word processor and finish your column. Otherwise,
Otherwise, I will be raining hell upon you.
Yeah, because our managing editor's on holiday in Dorset at the moment, hopefully keeping his head above water. Ben, you've got some stuff to proof. Me, I've got some Autosport pages to send out into the world before turning my attention to the column I've got to write for this month's issue. So,
or I'll be raining hell on you.
You're going to be doing a lot of raining, and quite frankly, I've seen enough rain today. Hence my current garb. So, Mark, thank you very much. We look forward to speaking to you again.
Thanks, Stuart. Hope your underpants dry out.
Hopefully. Otherwise, it's going to be a moist commute home. Ben Anderson, thank you very much.
I think it's been a pleasure.
To our poor benighted producer Martin Lee, thank you very much, and good luck editing this one down to under an hour. This has been Flatcher. I've been Stuart Codling. The October issue of F1 Racing is in your hands right now if you're a subscriber. If not, you'll find it on the newsstands tomorrow. selected features will be on Autosport Plus over the coming days and weeks. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next month.